Masturbator.
Oops. There's the intro.
One.
Welcome to Lug Radio. Welcome.
Hello. Season 3, episode 7.
It is indeed.
Yes. Episode 7. I genuinely can't believe that we're 7 episodes into the third season.
It's insane, well, isn't it?
It is.
It's insane in the membrane.
Insane in...
Welcome back,
everyone. Whoop, whoop. It's the sound of the police.
Who are you?
Eh?
Who are you?
I'm John O'Bacon.
You are?
Matthew Revolt.
You are?
Not Peter Oliver.
That's right, you are not Peter Oliver. Who are you?
Hey, Bradshaw. Hello.
Hello, I'm back. Nice to see you. Or
good
nice to see you.
Yeah, you go.
Well, that's deja vu.
What do you mean a wig? A wig, what mean you do?
What the fuck is all that?
Who should we talk to on the show today?
Should we talk to really Corey on Bungo?
That's Corey.
Second Life dude, yeah, that's
Corey. From Linden Labs, who makes Second Life.
Who makes Second Life. I want to talk about belief in open source.
Okay.
Should we talk about artists and getting artists involved in the open source way of thinking?
We really need it.
Orange sunglasses, yep.
Yep, we need to ship out, we need to get shipit.orangesunglasses.com, like shipit.ubuntu.com, and then we get them all on board.
And we'll read out our emails.
We will
indeed. That's about it.
I think that'll do us, to be honest.
All right, let's get on with it. Okay, in the past we've talked about artists, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And people who make pictures.
Those yes, graphic artists.
Usually referring to them as orange sunglasses wearing individuals.
That's graphite artists.
Sorry.
Lead and graphite are not the same thing.
Ah, obviously. Anyway, we've been talking in the past about how we've got loads of coders and we don't have enough artists. So how do we get more artists?
Well, this is the way I think you do it. You go up to their door, knock on it, and go, what will you wait for a bit? And they come to the door and say, Mr. Shirtlifter, Mr. Poof to a Shirtlifter, and they say,
yeah. Correct, as ever.
and then what do you say?
That was the face of, let's cancel this segment now. No, that's something I shouldn't have said.
So, hang on, let me get this right. So, you identify a graphic artist, and the way you get him to participate in the open source community by knocking on his door, calling him a puffter, and then just walking away.
No, that's just his name. That was just an example of someone's name.
Yeah.
No, how many people do you know called puffter?
No, once they've opened the door, how are you going to convince them to come
the worst
and work
my point was the worst serious
thing, right,
one.
If you were Mr. and Mrs. Shirtlift, would you call your son puffter?
What about the middle name? A. What's the A stand for,
Adrian.
Matthew? Oh, right. Puffed Adrian Shirley.
Anyway, here's the thing. My point was a serious one. You go out you ask people.
How'd you sell it to them? Come and work for us for nothing.
No. Listen. How do you sell it to coders then? How do you sell it to anyone who's involved?
It's in the genes.
It's not, though, because it is... At first, in our capitalist society, it seems like an illogical way of doing things.
The difference, I suspect, is that once a coder's written a piece of code, that piece of code then makes his life a bit better because he's written something to fix a problem that he's got. This is Raymond's scratch-your-own-itch thing. But artists, that doesn't happen to. I mean, if you've drawn a piece of art, either it hasn't made your life any better at all, or your life's better just because it's in the world, at which point, you know, why would you necessarily want to contribute to an open source community rather than hanging it on a wall in a gallery, for example?
So yeah, art's but basically useless, is what you're saying.
You wouldn't draw a 16 by 16 icon and hang it in the National Portrait Gallery.
Rothko might do.
I think the thing is...
Unless you're going to stick it on that webpage.
I think the thing that's holding people back is
the guy who sold his pixels.
The twat.
Oh, God.
He's a millionaire.
He's a knobhead.
He's a fucking millionaire. He's actually a millionaire. Last time I saw it, he'd done £720,000. And everyone's watching it going, fucking twat. And you can see people thinking, why did I think of that?
Exactly.
I could have fucking thought of that. And as soon as someone said $1 million homepage, I thought, he's just divided up into boxes and he's selling all the boxes. Cock, why didn't I think of it?
I think the thing is, though, is that I think the barrier to people getting involved is a bit too high.
It's not a challenge this week, is it?
It could be a challenge, an opportunity. But I think if you take a typical artist who might be familiar with drawing Apple applications, Max. But also probably familiar with CSS, I think going and making themes and things like
that. No, I think he's talking about non-technical artists.
There's a big difference between someone who's in a CSS and someone who...
Yeah, but what I'm saying is I'd say a technical artist, even then... The barrier is too high for a technical artist, so therefore a normal artist.
Why is that then? Why do you think it's
because,
high?
Because, well, I haven't looked into this in great detail, but to create a theme, and basically we need artists to create the themes.
Nah, beard. Right? You don't need artists to create... If artists came in and said, I will design you what Windows should look like, and just drew them, You'd have plenty of people who take that and chop it up into little bits to make a theme.
I think that's nice in theory, but not actually in practice.
But it would be nice to give it a try. And at the moment, if we're demanding that people not only have artistic ability, but the ability to make themes, you're right, it won't get anybody.
But that's what I think.
It would be a big step. I mean, if you look at the Tango, say, the Icons project, you don't just fucking make themes, do that. You just make icons.
Yes.
And they've got sort of four guys.
Yeah. But I think the problem is that I think it's nice in theory that people could essentially create a spec for a thing. And then people could, and then coders will go away and they'll implement
actually
that spec.
Do the work, yeah.
Whereas that doesn't really happen.
Here's what I think it is. I think that basically, going back to what I said earlier, I think it is a cultural thing. I think that within the open source movement has come out of a coding world. But there are lots.
Come out of there, Matt.
Shush. But there are
it's
lots
in your
of,
mind tonight, Matt.
You are, Jack. You are.
I thought so.
But there are lots of different ways that similar ideas to open source seeness and free software exist outside of coding, such as artist collectives of the 60s, where everything was free and sharing, man. And you know, you do have now people who still will give their music away for free because either they're not good enough. RecreantView.org. No, sorry. Either they're not good enough and they know that, or they just have this commitment to giving stuff away. So
coders...
Hang on. So I don't think it's necessarily that it's a coder-only thing, like you were saying, Aid. I think it's more just that the open source free software movement happens to have grown up this time, this type of movement happens to have grown up this time within the coding community, because Stallman did it because he saw a need in his own life that could be fulfilled by it.
And to push it forward, you needed to be a coder, really, to contribute in the early days.
Exactly. Of course, and it's grown up amongst those people.
But now we need the artists.
And so, so those people have known how to talk to other people like them. But they don't know how to talk to artists or musicians even. Like, there's often talk about why isn't there a Linux games market, or why isn't there an open source set of games? Well, you need more than just coders to do games. You need storytellers. You need...
And that's exactly why we've got 35 3D game engines and no actual games using them. Because making a game engine isn't the hard bit. The hard bit is sitting down and drawing.
And being creative.
35,000 rooms for the game to take place in, all of which is with perfect art. And it's really bloody hard to do that. And I think part of it is that art's kind of inherently less... collaborative. You know, someone needs to draw a finished piece of art, and then that's it. You can write half a program and then hand it off and someone else can pick it up.
I disagree. Let me tell you why. The Simpsons. How many animators do you reckon it takes to see The Simpsons, one episode of The Simpsons? Don't know the answer, but it's a lot. Because if you look at the list of animators in the credits, there's a hell of a lot of people there. And they work under what he created. He set down like the blueprints of the characters, and then the animators come along and they work from the storyboard.
Although, so to be fair, they're paid for it, aren't they?
Absolutely.
And you can collaborate on art so long as you pay for it. But I think what ACT means is it doesn't naturally lend itself towards community, naturalistic kind of
I don't see why it doesn't in any way less so than coding. Because to me, coding, you sit down and you write something and you've got something there that maybe scratches your itch. But up until about, say, 5-10 years ago, most coders, I bet you, and at least most coders I knew, would sit down and think, I've got something I can put on shareware and make a little bit of money out of.
Yeah, but a programmer could write a program and say, right, this is just what I need to do. I'm going to give this away now, and people can adapt this and use it themselves. But an artist can't, like, draw a picture and say, well, that does what I need it to do. I'm going to contribute it to society now, and people can take that picture and... See what I mean? You can't customise.
The thing with art as well is art, there's more of an embodied style as well. And there's different styles of development, but I think they're more compatible. Whereas if you take two artists, they're probably going to have radically different styles, which are more difficult to put together.
Yeah, but that's why you have an art director. I mean, we're talking now, I don't think we're now talking about projects that are one-man projects where someone just sits down and thinks, shit, I'd really love a... Well, no, you do get people sit down and think, I'd love a nice GNOME theme, I'll do one. But I think if you're talking about things like OpenOffice.org or you know, even the whole Ubuntu project, then you have artists who... You have an art director who'd say, right, this is my vision for how it should look, and what they say basically goes, and then lots of people implement it.
Open source.
University, that's how you get
them
interested.
But why not? Why not?
I know why not, but it's one of those things that's a great theory, but doesn't work in practice.
No, why not? Do you want me to say why?
Works for programming.
Exactly.
I know, but for some reason, I'm not saying that it's...
I've told you why I think it is.
I'm not saying it's a bad idea, don't get me wrong, but I'm just saying it just doesn't seem to work in practice.
Do you not have any buy-in to what I'm saying about... the fact that it just happens that this movement has grown up amongst coders. It's not that there's anything special about code.
I think because, it is.
No, I don't think it is, because I've been in, when I was younger, I used to be in writers' groups and things like that, and you would work collaboratively on a play or something like that. And the reason you want to do it is because you have the enjoyment of the collaborative process, which coders have. You know, and then you get the end product, which can be used by other people to build on, because you could. It's like fan fiction. People still write Buffy the Vampire Slayer fan fiction.
No, I agree, but the thing is, though, I don't think it's a coincidence that it's just coders who seem to have grown up around this, because the idea was around free software, and to create software, you need to be a coder.
In the traditional sense,
and I agree that a lot of it's tradition in the sense of there was 10 coders got together and started working on bits and pieces, and then that kind of inspired other programmers, and it's naturally pushed forward with coders.
Right. In the 1920s, the jazz movement.
When you were a lad.
Yeah, the jazz movement grew up, and that was people who were just jamming together and playing before lots of commercialism got involved. Before, I don't know, well, they've got the Blue Note jazz label, we've got Red Hat, the Linux distribution. But basically, it was just guys
and
in a bar
going
together.
Just like that, in fact.
Just like that. But then it grew into something else. There's no reason why open source isn't like the jazz of software
Bear me.
Go on, then.
We've talked a bit up there about why it hasn't happened so far. What could we do to fix it?
Go to nurture it at university.
I think it depends what you're talking about. I mean, in terms of theming, as an example, just one tiny example, I think if you take artists in general, people who are creatively minded, the one thing a lot of artists can do in terms of technical skills is CSS. I think we need to drive things.
I think you're on a red herring there, mate.
You really are.
I think if you take... I'm on about all artists. I'm talking about artists who are more technically minded. CSS
isn't a lot of them, to be fair.
Yeah, it isn't. But I'm not talking about if you take.
Why would you want CSS
if you take the
Ubuntu?
If you take the entire art world, right, in general, I accept that probably 10% of people.
There are a lot more web designers than there are, I would say, class of artists.
I know very few good web designers who are brilliant at CSS. Who have the first idea about sitting down and drawing a logo. I know lots of people who are fantastic in Illustrator drawing logos,
but they're different skills.
So why are you harping on about CSS?
This is just an idea of what I'm talking about. The idea is that themes are essentially a set of constructs to make an interface look a certain way, and CSS lends itself to that. Now, CSS is already an established... Well, how would you have an artist create a theme, then?
I would have them do what they do now, which is a sit-down with our equivalent of Illustrator. I can't remember what it's called.
Inkscape.
Yeah, sit down. And they know that they've got to create window corners. They know that they've got to create icons for OK and stuff like that. And they sit down, and they literally just draw them, hand them over as an EPS or a TIFF.
Yes.
And then someone implements it.
And that, importantly, is how all the really good CSS designers I know, that's how they work.
Yes,
they,
sure.
they produce comps in Photoshop or Illustrator first, and then think, how can I turn this into CSS?
Yeah.
So even if they were just creating the comps first of all, then someone, a mock-up, a graphic,
composition.
a pure graphic design, so it's just a...
I knew really, I was just asking for the listeners.
Right, okay. Beard. Right, so, I mean, okay, I mean, maybe CSS is good over theming, but the wider realm of artists, the sort of people Matt's talking about who design logos, people who can do an overall look of a desktop, how do we get them involved?
I think...
from what you were saying earlier, it sounded to me a bit like... The idea of doing that kind of art and the idea of open source development are quite incompatible. So is the only answer that you get Novell to pay them?
I think it seems as though they're incompatible. But
exactly. I think it only seems it because we're coming from the open source free software angle where it is much more collaborative, like you say, and there is this whole scratch your own itch thing. But the itch that would be scratched by artists, I believe, is one, portfolio building. Secondly, just personal satisfaction, because artists, people who... draw. They love to draw. They love to do that sort of thing. They get great satisfaction out of it.
I just don't know about the open source community.
Exactly. That's the whole point. That's why I said about the going to their door and knocking on it. Is literally, we have to tell people about it. It's not a case of...
How do you tell them?
I don't know. Do you know any artists?
Not really.
University seems the only place where you meet coders and artists in the same place.
Right,
university.
University is one place, but evangelise to people. In the way that you sell open source to people who want to have open office instead of office, sell it to someone who's, say, a 17-year-old girl who's about to start a foundation course before going to university, yeah? She wants to build a portfolio. She wants to go and work for, say, I don't know, some design studio down the road. It's really hard to build up a commercial quality portfolio to take to a design studio and say, this is what I do, employ me.
I totally agree, but that perspective applies to anything, really, doesn't it? If you want to be a coder, getting started with open source is a great way of starting. If you want to be a musician, contributing is a great way of starting.
But coding is an obvious endpoint. Whereas, if you're interested in computers, which you would be if you're coding, find out about Linux. You find out about the open source way of doing things. If you're an artist, you don't.
I think the thing is, imagine if we were just talking about getting artists involved. If we were talking about getting artists involved so they can create comps, right? And then those comps can be taken by somebody else. And let's assume that in a perfect world, the open source community has got a bunch of people who just love implementing other people's designs.
Yeah.
I 110% agree with you.
Right.
I just don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. I think it might happen, but I think people in the open source community don't really enjoy implementing other people's ideas. I think they enjoy coming up with their own ideas, which is part of the reason why I'm saying the only solution is to try and put the technology in more of a language that the artists understand. And CSS is one option. But it's certainly not a perfect option. But I agree with you, in a perfect world, you really want artists doing what they do best, creating artwork, and coders doing what they do best and converting that into code.
And until we can have that situation, we're not going to attract artists, because if you sit them down and say, right, thanks for designing that, now go and implement it in this thing that you don't understand, we're fucked.
They just can't, yeah. Second Life is a massively, massive online, massive, massive multiplayer, massive pig.
Or is it? I don't believe that it is, actually.
It's a massive online multiplayer world in which people can build things and live on land and have weird sex with each other.
So it's like Life, but it's a Second Life.
But it's a Second Life.
It's like Life, except it costs more money.
So your life costs around $40 a year.
Okay. Sorry, that's all I get to spend, isn't it?
So, anyway, they've promised, Linden Labs have promised that they're going to be releasing a Linux client, and this has been promised for a while, so we figured we should get Corey on the show to come and talk about it.
Absolutely, get him on the phone.
Hi, Corey, you're on Lug Radio, how are you doing?
Hey, welcome.
Hi. I'm doing great, how are you doing?
Not so bad. You're here with Ak, Aid, Matt and Jono.
Hello.
So,
hi.
Tell us what you do at Linden Labs, and tell us what Second Life is.
In 10 words or less.
Preferably. And be quick about it.
All right. Well, I'm the Vice President of Product Development, which is a long way of saying I wrote a lot of the original code over the last 5 years.
Ooh.
And Second Life, more broadly, is a user-created online world. So it's a home to over 100,000 people, and it's unique because everything in that place has been built by the residents, and they own everything they make.
Fantastic.
That's fantastic. I think probably the question that we're all dying to ask you, I think you probably already know the question, is when are we going to get a Linux client?
Well, so the Linux client, we did the first public testing / unveiling, since it had never before been run at the Chaos Communication Congress.
Yeah, we saw that.
And right now we are in the process of tidying it up just enough to do sort of a combination alpha compatibility test.
We want it.
Yeah, no, believe me, my inbox has been filling up with a wide variety of, please, 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 we need to use it now. And, well, the best part is, here are all my qualifications, why you should select me to be your first alpha tester. Here are
these 14 have you been writing?
I run.
Fantastic.
And I'll test it on all of them, I promise, which is fantastic. And we will be getting this out just as quick as we can. Obviously, during the holidays, we actually let people go home for a little while. And
oh, nice.
No.
Yeah, no, I know. It's crazy.
Lock them up.
It slowed down things just a little bit. And we actually saw one of the check-ins from our primary port guy was coming in today. So we should be ready to go here, real soon now. How about that?
Time frame?
Excellent.
Give us a day. So,
yeah,
come on.
I mean,
week?
Any ideas on date?
No.
Oh, go on. Come on, man.
Grand.
Real soon now. That's the
okay.
RSN. One thing that really interests me about Second Life is that you give all the users intellectual property rights over anything that they create within the game.
That seems like something that you didn't have to do. I'd be interested to know why you did do it and what benefits it gives the players. I mean, what can you create that you would want intellectual property rights over?
So we actually launched not doing it that way, and we had a sort of roundtable discussion a couple months after we launched, and one of the guests at that roundtable was actually Larry Lessig, and Larry kind of looked at what we were doing and in classic Larry style, very eloquently informed us that we were big idiots, because here you are asking people to build a world and then not letting them own it.
And he's going to be in the world, isn't he?
That's pretty stupid. And, I mean, he said it very, very politely and very, very intelligently, but that's basically what he was saying. And if you look at sort of growth of economies over historical times, they're never successful when you say, hey, go do this great stuff, but by the way, you're doing it all for the man, right? That always
happens. Right, yeah. You didn't want to be like a dictatorship.
That's right. And so when we looked at it from just the standpoint of we wanted our residents to be able to be as innovative as possible, it makes a lot more sense to allow them to actually own their creations. And so that was sort of a big transitional point in our thinking about this. And so we changed that as quickly as we could. And that was a real tipping point for Second Life growth. So I think the evidence sort of speaks for itself of that being able to actually have this opportunity to not have to be working for the man turns out to be pretty important. In terms of, you know, what you can do, you know, the best example is Tringo. Tringo was a game written by an Australian programmer during his holiday break that swept Second Life. It was enormously successful within Second Life and very popular, and he got to do sort of all of his design and testing and play testing all within the virtual world.
Wow.
And it was so successful that it's going to be on the Game Boy Advance here in about another week.
That's astonishing.
That's amazing.
That is absolutely amazing.
Right, I mean, so here you have a game that was completely designed and built inside a virtual world that's now coming out to the real world.
Crumbs. That's amazing.
Sitting next to Penfold.
What else happens within Second Life other than people creating computer games, things like that? Because, I mean, this is something that's fascinated me for years, but I've never actually played a proper MMORPG or whatever they're called. Tell me what it's all about.
Well, Second Life is certainly not an MMORPG, right? The Morpig, if you haven't played it, let me, you know, familiarize you with it briefly.
Okay.
You walk around, you meet rats, and you kill the rats.
Sounds good so far.
You kill bigger rats, and that's basically the game.
Right.
And so, and that's fine. I mean, the sort of Dungeons & Dragons leveling is a very classic gameplay mechanic, and that's how it's been translated into the Morpig.
Yeah.
Second Life isn't a game. Second Life doesn't have any game components like that. When you come in on your first moment in Second Life, you can do whatever you want to do right away. You don't have to say, you know, run around for 3 days and, oh, well, now you can make stuff. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
And in terms of asking the question, what do people make in Second Life, what do people do in Second Life, you know, really the question is there anything that people don't do in Second Life? Because you put people into a physically simulated creative world where they're surrounded by a community of people who want to explore the world and explore the design space. People who, their first question when they get somewhere is, well, what can I do?
Yeah.
And it turns out that you can do a lot, and they start playing with it. And it's everything from building communities and clubs and social structures to building real tangible things, you know, vehicles and guns and weapons and games and experiences. And really, you see people running the gamut of building just about anything you can imagine and probably several things you can't imagine.
I mean, I played Second Life very briefly, and I was looking through the site as well about how Linden Labs makes some money from this. And obviously the big thing is selling land, and people pay, just to inform our listeners, people can buy a plot of land in there, and then they pay rent for that land in real money. Is that right?
That's basically right, yeah. We are in the virtual real estate business.
Yeah.
And you can either be buying the land from us, or it turns out that there are a lot of residents who actually compete with us.
Right.
And so the residents buy the land from us, and then they resell the land to other residents. And so you actually have a lot of options about whether you pay us in real U.S. dollars or you pay other residents using the in-world currency.
Because, I mean, my question is really aimed around the concept that you've got the basic account and you've got the kind of the premium account. And obviously, somebody who buys a premium account, someone who's got some money, gets more out of Second Life. How are you trying to make money, but also trying to retain some kind of equality in Second Life, so you don't just have a certain subset of people who can afford to buy all of this land and just rule it and don't really do anything creative with it?
Yeah, good question.
Well, I think that you know, that's obviously a really broad question. You know, it comes down to, are you trying to build, you know, Disney World, or are you trying to build Burning Man? Burning Man, for people who don't know, is this incredible temporary community that springs up in the Black Rock Desert of Nevada for a week during the summer.
Yeah.
And it's just this incredible collection of people who come out and just do crazy things in the real world. And you sort of look at that, or you look at how cities grow. Mm. Like cities don't grow by prior planning. They grow up very accretively. They grow up based on all sorts of variables that are incredibly complex. You could never get them all in your head sort of ahead of time.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
On the other side of the coin, you have Disney World, right? You know, somewhere there's a guy, you know, Frozen or whatever, but, you know, who said, Disney World will look like this, and that's what it will be.
Yeah.
And, you know, with Second Life, when you look at putting creative tools in the hands of the residents, there's just no way you're going to be able to say a priori, here are all the things they're going to do, and they should do it. You know, on this sim, you're going to make vehicles only, and on this sim, you're only going to make clothes. I mean, that would just be silly.
Sure.
And so, you know, broadly, we want to leave the world really open. In terms of how people use the world, and the important thing to remember is you don't have to own any land to build. You only need to own land in Second Life if you want permanence in the world. So if you want a piece of yourself in the world when you're not logged in, like you want a house that stays there when you're not there, or you want a shopping mall or a roller coaster or a, you know, an airport to exist when you're not there, then you need to own the land to support it, or you need to find a patron who owns the land to support it.
Right.
Okay. Who will pay for that land when you're not there. And, you know, one of our most successful business people in the world, a resident whose in-world name is Anshe Chung, who actually lives in Germany, she likes to talk about the fact that she started out with her, you know, basic account and has bootstrapped herself all the way up.
What does that mean, bootstrapped?
Well, she started doing some things in World, made a little bit of money in World, flipped that into U.S. dollars, used that to pay for a premium account, used that to buy some land, resold the land, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
That comes on to an interesting point, then. To what extent does Second Life spill over into people's first lives? Do people meet up? Do they have babies? What happens?
The crossover into the real world is it's very tightly coupled. I think that initially one of the areas where we probably guessed incorrectly was that we would have thought that people would want to keep sort of things like identity in their lives somewhat separate.
Yeah.
And that even though there'd be all these economic and information connections between Second Life and the real world, that people wouldn't go out of their way to meet other Second Life residents. And what's turned out is that that's not the case at all, that people are building these very strong social connections in the real world in addition to the ones that they build in Second Life. So, for example, when Katrina hit New Orleans, one of the first things we heard about were residents who had friends living in New Orleans saying, drive as far north as you can, we'll meet you and come live with us.
Wow,
and
right.
And we'll take care of you.
Real community.
And we see meetups happening all over the place. Basically, whenever residents figure out that there are enough of them in a city, they just start holding meetups. And what's really interesting is these connections are both, you know, purely social, where it's like, hey, well, we've built this relationship between avatars. Let's now go build this relationship in the real world.
Yeah.
But it's also this very practical sort of business motivations as, you know, people who run stores or have businesses start saying, hey, you know, I met you in World, and you're this really good scripter. I'd like to go meet you in the real world so we can build even a better connection, figure out what more we can do or who else do you know. And so it's this great overlapping of social networks that completely bypass the membrane between Second Life and the real world.
Cool.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing the way that it's kind of developed. Just moving on to the technical side of things, though. So on the back end, I believe it's all open source service?
Yeah, it's basically Debian plus all the things that you would expect.
So why did you choose open source service?
Because
was it economic choice
to successfully run the product?
Was it for stability then?
Pardon me?
Was it for stability?
Yeah, no, obviously it was stability and the fact that so we run on a distributed grid. It's, you know, over 1,000 machines, over 1,800 simulators running at this point.
Right.
And as we were rolling that out, I couldn't afford to hire, you know, 20 sysadmins and 4 DBAs and all this other stuff. There's just no way we could have done that. And
right.
So we like to talk about the fact that we had more than 500 machines deployed before we hired our second sysadmin.
Wow.
And you can only do that with something like Debian, where every night you're just system imaging everything and you know, life is good. That's just happy days.
And excellent.
So, you know, the database is MySQL because, again, the last thing you want to be doing, I mean, there are many companies that have been built, you know, running Oracle.
Sure.
And that's certainly, you know, their decision. But I think that, you know, in the realm of, you know, there being correct answers to things, Oracle is very rarely the correct answer.
Well, because, I couldn't agree more on that.
Yeah, well, just because if it does break, you either have to have this really expensive DBA who then looks to you and says, "Oop, I don't know." And then you have to, like, parachute in the Oracle engineers to figure it out.
Totally.
You know, the great thing with MySQL, and especially for the kind of fairly simple database queries you tend to do in managing a world like this, you know, SQL is actually very, very fast. And so that's been fantastic. Actually moving data around, a big part of that's just Apache. You know,
so is the code that runs the world going to be open sourced?
Eventually, yes, but that's a ways out.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I think that you can look at the Netscape model.
What about the client?
Pardon me?
What about the client?
No, absolutely.
Yeah,
but again, you know, that it will eventually be open source. It's going to be open standards long before it's open source, though.
Cool.
Because, excellent, you know, you don't want to run into sort of the Netscape problem where you have this code base that was developed to be closed source, and then one day you sort of go, hey, it's open source. and, you know, if you look at having...
We'll spend months cleaning up.
We're midstream of integrating Firefox, actually, and so we're very familiar with that code base. And a lot of the problems when you look at that code base spring from the fact that it really was never designed to be open source software.
You're
sort of playing this constant catch-up game of going, what we meant to do is make it small pieces loosely joined, and, you know, we'll get there sometime in 2010. And so I think with the Second Life code base, we're in a very similar situation where long run, of course, it has to be open source. There's no question.
So from the ground up, you designed it to be open source eventually?
Well, we didn't. I think that, you know, we basically designed it to get it running as quickly as possible. We optimized for programmer time you have to understand, we started up in late 2000.
Yeah.
And running a startup tech company in San Francisco in that time period, you didn't know how long your time horizon was. We really had to make sure that we optimized for, we need to get this product out there. We need to get into alpha. We need to get into beta. And so we very much originally optimized for programming time. So now we're in a situation where we have the opportunity as our customer base continues to grow, and we look at the kinds of things that people want to be doing with Second Life, that the next step is open standards, open standards, open standards, right? You know, we have an IM system. Stupidly, it's not Jabber. Will it be an open standard pretty soon? Well, yes, right? Because then when people want to say, hey, I want to write my own IM client that talks to Second Life, it's easy.
Yeah.
Whereas if you try to do that today, it would be virtually impossible.
Right.
Cool. No, so you talk about open standards. You're happy with people, you'd be happy with people implementing their own clients to it rather than using yours?
No, absolutely. Because here's the thing, you know, we will always have a client that does a certain set of things. There are going to be other people who say, I want to get into Second Life off my cell phone. I want to be able to get into Second Life off of my really low-end...
Not my phone.
You know, and I'm willing to dispense with a certain percentage of either, you know, the visual quality or the editing tools or whatever, because I just want a way to be able to, you know, talk to my friends or buy stuff or sell stuff or whatever.
Yeah, cool.
And why presume that we'll ever be a large enough company to do all to satisfy all of those needs? I mean, that's just silly.
Yeah.
So by going to open standards, we get around that. And, you know, more importantly on open standards, we're asking people or we're giving people the opportunity to build very successful businesses within Second Life. And in asking them to do that, you know, there's this tremendous trust that we're demanding in return, right? Because we're saying you have to trust Linden Lab to not completely screw the pooch on this thing.
Do what?
That actually has value in Second Life.
Yeah.
And the more we use open standards, the more people can be predictive about where things are going and not have to worry about us saying, well, we've done this update and now, you know, your client can't talk to us anymore.
Talking about you screwing the pooch leads quite neatly into the question I was going to ask, which is, the thing I find fascinating about it is all the ethical dilemmas it throws up. How, because you're the guys who've got the servers...
And here I thought you were going to ask about the furry community.
I suspect there's probably a load of them on Second Life, but they're quite welcome to have their Second Life somewhere away from my Second Life. The ethical question for the thing fascinates me. How much control do you intend to exert over the world? If someone invents the Ebola virus inside Second Life,
Would you just sort of, you know, have the fickle finger of God reach in and put a stop to it?
Sorry, what is it, to do what?
Someone invents something which kills people's user accounts.
Well, so...
Say. Or they invent, you know, a digital analogue of the Ebola virus. Something right. which interferes with other people's enjoyment of the game. Well, but so you could do that in the real world, so,
sure,
so can you do it in Second Life?
So right now, we run all the servers. We host all of them. Right, so you have all these machines sitting in a co-location facility in San Francisco, which means absent an entirely separate discussion about cyber law, to first approximation, Second Life, it needs to be governed by the rules of California and San Francisco and the United States, right? Because here's where the servers are, and if you can move guns to where the servers are, the guns win, right? And so right now, those are the rules.
Yeah.
Which means that there are a host of decisions that we need to make to protect both ourselves as a company and Second Life as a product, right? You know, we need to be a company that stays in business and is successful, et cetera, et cetera. One of the many reasons to go to open standards is in the long run, I want you to be able to host a server.
Right.
And at that point, there's a
really?
Whole issue of how do I move from these Linden Lab servers to go visit your server? And you know what? Those are pretty standard trust issues that we've been
yeah.
playing with in the web for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
It's everything from saying, you know what, you can only move identity over to your server to, hey, you know, you're going through some trust and you have a seal program, so we're agreeing that, you know, you have additional identity associated with you and therefore implying more trust if I'm going to go visit your machine.
Sure, yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? But the reality is, much like going to a website, much like giving your credit card to a website, it's all a trust issue. Right, there's nothing that says, there's nothing technically that prevents, you know,
yeah.
Amazon from having an order site that they sort of forget to whole turn on that whole, you know, security layer and, you know, da-da-da-da-da, right?
Yeah.
But because you know that that's their business model to not do that, and Amazon's been around long enough to establish trust and brand and everything else, you're willing, quite happy to give them your credit card number.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
So I think when you look long-term at how a place like Second Life grows, and again, this just comes back to why we need to go to open standards. In the long run, you should be able to set up a server that's playing by the rules of wherever your server is. And if I want to go be a tourist on your server, we need to provide infrastructure to allow that. But we also need to tell you, hey, the rules might be changing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, okay, quick question then. You built Second Life. Seems to work quite well. What's going to be in Third Life? What's not in Second Life that you wish you could do?
Well, I don't think there'll ever be a Third Life. I think Second Life will just get better. You know, we joke that the building tools don't have hierarchy, and that's one of the great mistakes we made very early on in the process. It makes it much harder to build
hierarchy.
Complex 3D objects.
Right.
So you can do collections of things, but you can't do, you know, you can't have a pendulum that's hanging underneath that's complicated, et cetera, et cetera. And that was, you know, all of us who were around 4 years ago remember the conversation where we decided, oh, we'll do that later. And that was a tremendous
yeah.
oversight
oh,
on our part.
No kind of
but, you know, these things happen. You know, these little boo-boos.
Yeah.
The other thing, actually, because I didn't actually answer your question about, you know, governance in this space, our goal is to have as little control as possible. So right now we need a fair amount of control because we need to stay in business and not do things that are illegal. But in the long run, we want Second Life to be out there and let the residents be determining the rules because, after all, it's their place.
Hmm. Yeah.
Cool.
Just to wrap up, obviously we're a Linux-orientated podcast. And just through browsing some of the forums and things like that on the Second Life website, there's been a lot of people seem to have been fairly let down in the past by the fact that it's been the Linux client's been promised for quite some time, but it's taken quite a while to deliver. The final question is this going to be a fully supported Second Life product, or is it just going to be a weird offshoot that not many people use? Is this going to be as supported as the Windows and Mac clients?
It's going to be as supported as the Windows and Mac clients.
Cool.
You know,
fantastic.
The reality of cross-platform development is that it's a process, it's important, and it makes your code better.
Right.
You know, the fact that you're doing cross-compiling, the fact that you have to go through the rigor to do multiple releases, it does cause a little bit of pain. The port causes a little bit of pain. You know, the reality is that the feature set on the Linux version is probably going to lag a little bit while we get it caught up. Like, we don't have audio working on it yet.
Right.
But the goal is, because again, this comes right back to open standards and long-term direction, the more unified that code base is and the more modular it is, the easier all of these things are. And frankly, you know, the rigor required to have the Linux client working is an important part of us improving the state of our code.
Yeah.
And all the rest of our code has been cross-compiling on everything forever. So this is not new to us.
Okay,
right.
You know, the Linux client was simply a question of when I could get resources to throw at it. And, you know, Iculus has been finally freed up as he got through the Christmas rush of porting games that he tends to do.
Sure, yeah.
And was finally able to come back to it. He really blasted through it, and, you know, there's some things left to do, but, you know, he's got time right now, so
yeah.
He's going to be blasting through it. And frankly, you know, the four or five really hardcore Linux users on my dev team are just, they're running around saying hallelujah right now.
Yeah, sure.
Because they're ready to stop having Windows on their machine.
Hooray!
So
yeah.
They're pretty happy about that.
No, it seems great news, and we're really pleased that you could come on the show. I'm sure we could all sit here and talk to you for hours on end. But,
absolutely.
No more questions. Yeah. For the invitation.
But thanks so much, and keep up the good work. And
we'll catch up with him.
We look forward to seeing the Linux client out there and Second Life growing.
Well, I look forward to all you guys testing it.
Nice.
Oh, yeah.
Can we come back to you at some point in the future for a 5-minute update to see how things are going?
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much.
Thanks
Corey.
A lot, Corey.
Cheers. Bye. Here's the thing I don't understand. Why is it that he's going on about... Sorry, why is he eloquently discussing the idea that you have to stick to real San Francisco, Californian law? I don't get it. It's a virtual world.
I looked into this, working for a law firm and
all. Oh, right.
The reason you have to do things like that in...
it's a virtual world.
The reason this sort of discussion has come up in virtual worlds in general, very specifically in Second Life,
right.
Is if you imagine you've paid money for some land.
Real money.
Yeah, real money, and you've bought land.
Yeah.
And then some guy works out a way inside the game to have that land transfer ownership to him.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Then, on the one hand, you could say, okay, well, that needs to be enforced in Second Life. On the other hand, you are genuinely out of pocket. He has stolen your money there, your real money, virtual bullshit Linden dollars, proper real money, at which point you then turn around and sue. Yeah. In exactly the same way, there were a lot of really big discussions about in other Morg Pig, or whatever called, right?
That's a Black Sabbath song, isn't it?
Yeah. Morg Pig! in other role-playing games, people were doing things like building up really, really, really good characters and then selling them on eBay.
Yeah.
And then there was a big question about whether you had the right to do that, whether you owned that, or whether you owned the character you spent all the money, all time and effort, and £14.99 a month on. Or whether the people who wrote the game did it, which is why I think Linden have specifically gone, if you create something, you own it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you've got the right to steal shit off other people.
Mm. Could I be a traveller and like set up camp on your land?
As far as I'm aware,
I think you pay fees for going onto people's land in certain
situations.
A bit
like Monopoly.
I think so. I don't know. The land thing
is a hotel.
It's quite a complex issue.
Put a small dog on it.
I've been playing around.
It is a very interesting subject.
Like I said, I've been playing around with it recently, and I registered one of the premium accounts because it's about $40, which is basically
for a year.
For a year, which is basically
fuck all,
to be honest. And you get $500 a week, $500 Linden dollars a week, which means you can go around buying stuff. But you get enough.
Presumably just for passing go, you don't have to do anything.
You just
$500 Linden.
You get stuff. You can do everything straight away.
Yeah.
You don't have
With the basic account, you get $50 Linden dollars a week as long as you log in. So you can still get money if you log into it. But you get a plot of land. So you can buy, they've got this first land idea where there's 512 square metres, and you buy it for 512 Linden dollars.
That's fucking tons of land, by the way, 512
You'd
square
think,
metres.
But in the game, it doesn't actually seem to be that much land. But, so I was reading into it, because with this first plot of land, you don't have to pay any real money fees for it. That's what you get with
Even in a basic premium account.
This is just with the premium
account. Okay.
And then you can buy money afterwards. But the whole land thing's a real... it's like really buying land. It's quite a serious concern in the game.
It's an interesting thing as well. I noticed that there's something about if the whole database goes down, then they don't claim have any reliability for the loss of your money or something like that.
Yeah, you'd have to do that, though, wouldn't you?
You'd have to do that. Because
people are building real businesses in there, you know, and you can't be responsible for them going down.
Don't sue God if the universe goes down.
Exactly.
Act of God. Hard drive failure.
This is precisely the point. I mean,
God pulled the plug out.
The reason I asked the question there is that I've got no problem with them saying we disclaim liability if the servers go away, but you can't couple that with the ability to just go in and break shit because you're God. You either have to say, we are hands off, you lot do what you want, and we can't fuck about with it. Or you say, we're entitled to fuck about whatever we like, but then, if your business goes away because our server crashes, we'll compensate you for it.
Yep.
And they've taken the free love, smoke, dope approach to it, which is brilliant. Well done, Larry Lessig.
Did you see the thing about Larry Lessig? Larry Lessig is making an appearance in the Second Life world to give a seminar in the Second Life world about free culture.
Hmm.
And there's a virtual version of the book, Free Culture, that he's autographing in the Second Life world. And it's stuff like that where, I know it sounds really weird, but I can imagine for a lot of people, they'll feel a bit more like they've met him.
Well, you really have met him. Yeah.
Because I mean, I logged in and it does feel more like a world.
How did you log in, John? There's no Linux client.
Well, I bow down to Windows, again. I'm afraid.
Quick question, what graphics sort of capabilities do you need? Could I run it on my laptop?
You need a reasonably beefy graphics card. I run it on the little Vio, and that comes with like integrated graphics that's supposed to be good.
I've got like an NVIDIA sort of thing.
Oh, NVIDIA cards and ATI cards will run fine. I mean, the one in this machine is really, really shit and all.
John gestures behind him.
But it's fascinating. I mean, I met a bloke once who apparently earns €100,000 a year running a casino in there.
Was he hugely fat?
He was an ugly...
Was he virtually
an ugly
fat?
This is my question. Bit of a serious question, bit of a joke question. But if you're having an extensive Second Life, do you have very little First Life, do you think? Does it take over?
By definition. But then again, there's a bleed over, isn't there? I mean, I know somebody who's met people in Second Life and then met them in real life.
Yeah. I suppose it's like IRC, you know.
Or Usenet.
Or Usenet, yeah.
Much more Usenet, I'd say, than IRC.
It's like Lug Radio. I mean, the Lug Radio community met up. And
then we actually met up at Lug Radio Live.
We actually met up, yeah.
Yeah.
So, fascinating stuff.
Yeah, good.
In the last week or so, I've read a couple of announcements which are entirely unconnected except in my brain. One of them is the Red Hat, Fedora.
Mm.
The Fedora Core project have decided to include Mono in Fedora Core 5.
Good stuff,
Over Red Hat's objections, as I understand it.
Yep, good on them.
And the second one was something Benjamin Mako Hill wrote.
Yep,
is that how you pronounce it?
About how, I believe that's how you pronounce it. I mean, it's Hill, it's just H-I-L.
Chit.
Benjamin Mako Hill Chit.
But he wrote an article, an essay, whatever you want to call it, saying that if you believe in free software, then you should be prepared to, as well as preaching the goodness of free software, live without the stuff that free software can't yet bring you, like MP3s or Flash.
Is it an RMS?
Hey?
Mako.
Is he what?
Sorry. Mako. RMS.
Is he what?
RMS.
I get the impression he's very... That thing that he wrote seemed very, very RMS-y. You know, he seems quite inspired from RMS.
I don't necessarily think so, but that's because I think you're using the initials RMS as a closet insult. But
no, I mean it in a genuine way as somebody who... somebody who's willing to sacrifice... aspects of the world for their ideals.
Sort of thinks other people
fair play. Anyway, it got me thinking about something that I've seen but not particularly articulated in the free software community, which is that I think you see a lot of people have more respect for stuff developed by proper closed source companies. You'll see, people say, yes, I believe in free software and I use free software, absolutely. But when something comes along done by a proper company... then there seems to be a kind of feeling that it's somehow better than things that the free software community have produced. And that's one of the things that I think has informed the take-up of Mono. I think I agree with a lot of people who are saying, yes, it's a very good programming environment, whatever. I mean, I don't personally like it, as you know, but that's not the point. Lots of people say it's a good programming environment. Mm. I'm therefore going to believe them because they say that. But I think there's a certain amount of, a certain undercurrent of, well, it was done by real people. You know, it's done by Microsoft. They're a proper company. It's not something that's just been knocked up in someone's back room.
Aid said this in the past, haven't he?
Yes,
absolutely,
He has. And it's something, I think it's interesting that that this is there, that you've got a lot of people who genuinely, truly believe in free software. But yet, if real companies do something, they think, well, that's a little bit better, isn't it? So let's try and emulate that. And I don't know whether there's not as much of a belief in free software as there should be, or whether that's just the way it is, or
is that not just because paid for companies who can pay for development time are able to
build better products.
Products. I mean, is that not just...
That's just natural.
But that's entirely contrary to the argument that open source produces better stuff.
Not necessarily, because open source can produce better stuff, but there are the knobs and the edges and that need to be knocked off that people don't necessarily like doing. You know, the rough corners that people don't necessarily
send
like.
Send it off.
Yeah. Like we were talking earlier about icon themes and templates and stuff like that, or later.
So the quality, quality of coding is better in an open source environment, but surely if you've got a load of paid programmers who are just paid to sit there and do that job,
then they will do what they have to do.
This is exactly the point I'm trying to make. I mean, you're saying that, and that's quite a reasonable argument, but people who are keen on open source tend not to make that argument. They tend to say, no, that's not the case. Closed source development processes do not produce better products. Whether that's to do with the roundness of the product or the underlying code quality of the product
I'm not talking about closed source. I'm talking about paid for as opposed to volunteer time.
I don't agree with you then, because I don't think people feel the same way about stuff that Novell have produced as open source but paid for that they do... That they do about other things. No, I don't think people are respecting Mono because Novell have done it and they've paid programmers. No, I think people are respecting Mono because it's .NET.
Right, what about OpenOffice then? Do you think that OpenOffice...
Look at me right now and tell me OpenOffice is as good as Office.
Oh, well, I don't believe it is. I never said it was.
And
for the I don't think it's that far away.
I think the thing is I agree with Ack on this in the fact that I think there's kind of... And I don't want to sound like some kind of weirdo sociological bullshitter, but I think it's kind of a consumerist sort of thing. I think we're brought up as kids with a degree of faith in products. And so therefore, when this faceless company creates a product, I remember before I got into open source,
consumers.
And I was a Windowsy person, I thought that Microsoft software was better because it was in a box and it was a big company and therefore it was better. And I think part of it is just the open source way of thinking is that you challenge really everything that you believe in. So therefore, people do naturally take to it. And I agree Mono's been popular because Microsoft have pushed it. And as much as people have been put off Mono because Microsoft have pushed it, I think as many people have gone to it because they've pushed it. And it feels like a proper language in...
Can I ask then where you think that Firefox sits in all this? Because it came from Netscape.
Firefox is interesting because... You don't get the same feeling about Firefox that you do about a lot of things where, you know, we're doing really good things in the open source world, but then a real company comes up with something and that's better. People don't seem to feel that about Firefox, but I don't know whether they don't feel about Firefox because it's actually good, or they don't feel about Firefox because it was a closed source product and then it went open, or they don't feel it about Firefox because there are big companies involved with it, or what? I don't really understand it.
My theory as to what it might be, I think it's part of it is because it's got a good name, because it's got a nice logo, but also the most important thing is it's just better. It is a fantastic product. Whereas if you look at OpenOffice, most people who would come to it from a Microsoft Office point of view would say it's not better. Whether they're right or wrong, they would say it's not better. They'd say it's not as good. But Firefox is demonstrably better, IMO anyway, than any other browser out there.
I think there's a couple of other issues. The major thing is that it works on Windows. And because it's Windows, a lot of people can access it. Mm. B, it works the same as Explorer, so there's no kind of... It's not only easy to install, but it actually is the same in terms of use. So therefore, there's no real mental outlay to use Firefox. And then you get all of these extra benefits that people love tab browsing. Yeah, you don't get that in IE, but the basic functionality of Firefox is there, and then they pile
and they build
extra
on
bits
it.
On it.
Yeah.
And let's not forget that Spread Firefox has really fucking pushed it. And the Mozilla Foundation and all the Firefox people are really well organised.
I totally agree
with you. The Firefox people have got into the marketing.
And advocacy.
And advocacy. Yeah. But I think part of it is there aren't that many open source products where if you talk to everybody or a vast majority of people who use them, that it's open source wouldn't be on the list of reasons why they're using it.
I went
a bit round the house on that. If you look at people using, say, Thunderbird, a reasonable proportion of people using Thunderbird, I would say, are using it because it's open source.
Because it's not out of Firefox.
More than 50% or less?
I don't know. It could be more. It could be less. I would say... More than, probably, at the moment.
But they are early adopters.
They are early adopters. But Firefox, I mean, OpenOffice, again, people are using it because it's open source.
I don't know with OpenOffice. I think with OpenOffice, people a lot of people are using it because it's free.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Yeah, no. Fair play.
We don't mean as in.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, web browsers are a bit complicated there because web browsers are free anyway.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, the Opera people are convinced that you can make a web browser and sell it for money, and it doesn't.
And
work.
We say beer.
Well, they're not anymore because giving it away. Now.
Yeah, they are now giving it away.
Chin degraded.
Firefox. I would say if you look at the vast majority of Firefox users, they not only haven't had its open source as a reason to choose it, but they probably don't even know.
Yeah.
They're using it because it's a good browser.
Is that a good or a bad thing?
It's the only way we're going to win.
I think it's a good thing because it shows that open source works as a development model.
Yes, I mean,
produces better stuff.
I would love to live in a world. I would love to live in Mako's world where people say, "I will choose this because it enforces the freedom principles in which I believe."
Yeah,
and I would love people to believe in those principles and then act on those principles. And so would Mako Hill, as far as I'm aware, and so would RMS.
But
we
know that that's not the real world.
But it's not going
to
happen.
But I don't believe we do live in that world. I'd like to. But this is the whole point. RMS thinks we don't live in that world, so we need to make the world like it.
It's similar to the question. Bringing it back to marketing, it's similar to the question of. Is it more important to market something and get people, or to actually do your product to make sure your product works well as a product or a service? Is it more important to spread the word of open source than, you know, if once we've got these people, do we need to keep on banging about open source? Because fundamentally, it seems to be about software.
I tell you what,
it kind of goes back to what Ak said about doing the right thing and doing the best thing.
Yeah,
long time ago.
It goes back slightly. Sorry to interrupt. About the thing I was talking about last week about the Google operating system.
Mm.
Because if Google Brown operating system is based on Linux and loads of people start using it because it's Google, they don't have to care that it's open source.
Yes,
but
yeah.
We get loads of benefits because then loads of people are running Linux, even if they don't know.
Yep.
Yeah, and if people start using Firefox, then we'll have websites can be more compliant and things like that. And we get the benefits of them using an open source browser with open standards.
Well, we're going to get there now because Internet Explorer isn't being built for the Mac, so naturally they have to use a different browser. So
Safari,
or Firefox. You know, so.
But here's the thing, though. Going on to the Mako Mako makeover show thing.
The Mako Mako makeover show.
One thing
that'd be a really cool show. I'd watch that.
The one thing that annoys me about his post and posts in that spirit, in that general sentiment, is that I grew up in a Christian fundamentalist environment where
you did.
People preached at you and there was a right way and you were meant to do things the right way, and if you didn't you'd go to hell, right? It fucks me off.
As opposed to going to Redmond, which is all freaked off when people get off here as a punishment.
Yeah, it annoys me.
Which we'd
me.
All do if the money was there.
Well, I don't know.
See a previous episode for that.
Again, documentary evidence that you would go there if the money was there, or even if the money wasn't there, if I recall rightly.
Yeah, I think you were the one who'd go there without the
I'll
money.
Do it for a fiver.
I don't think we've ever had an interview where Matt hasn't asked for a job at the end of it. As well.
The Microsoft one was a joke. Right.
Beard. sorry, Matt, you're making a point.
I'm very happy with my current employment. Now, listen to me. The point was that I resent people trying to tell me how to live my life.
Yes.
And getting all preachy and shirty about it.
It does tend
and
to leave you
they
cold.
Might, they might believe it. They might genuinely believe it. But here's the thing. You walk down the street in Wolverhampton, there's a little guy who stands in his pork pie hat going, "Jesus will save you." And that don't mean anything. It really doesn't mean anything. The witty posters outside churches that say things like, "Oh my God, you called?" You know, trying to get you to, you know, have a laugh. They won't make anyone a Christian,
but
right?
But that's something that's wrong with preaching, though, isn't it?
Exactly,
general?
that's my point. Yeah. I don't like people preaching because it damages the community, in my opinion, because it makes us seem like zealoty wankers. I'm not saying that Mako
not
does,
preaching,
I'm saying
no.
The preaching does. And secondly, it just makes everyone have this real down guilt feeling of, oh shit, well, you know, I want to live in the real world, but I can't use that, look at that flash animation of some badges going up and down, because it's not free software.
I think the thing is, I mean, I really respect Mako for his perspective, and I think if we could basically flick a switch, it would be great to have a world like that where it's all about freedom and all the rest of it, but I think the problem with it is that it's all one way. It's as bad as it is saying, "I want everything closed source." Everything. Saying, "I want everything free" is as equally bad. not just in terms of whether it's open or closed source, but just taking one huge perspective shift from one side to the other. I don't think it's healthy. I think it's good to have some balance.
It's a question for you.
I don't agree with you there, because, first of all, software should be free.
Why?
And the second thing we should have some balance, right?
Yeah.
For someone who genuinely believes in free software, saying we should have some balance, therefore we should have some closed source software, is like saying we should have some balance. When we arrest people who abuse kids, we should let half of them go.
This is exactly my question.
Can I just clarify?
Yeah, but I need to come in after
this, right?
Yeah.
Just to clarify, I'm not saying we should have closed source software. What I'm saying is having a singular opinion that's really, like, take an RMS as an example, because Maker...
Extremes is what
Maker,
you're talking about.
Maker readily admits that he's not 100%, he doesn't live his life 100% as this pure free software bloke, right? But RMS does.
Well, he's got no conviction then.
But RMS does, right? And the thing is, the thing is that with RMS, that seems to me it's too far in one direction. And
it's an extreme. And
never
fly
on an
extreme, extremes aren't healthy in any situation.
Not healthy.
All right,
you've got to have balance.
It is my thing, right?
Oh, lovely.
I really want to... this is what I was going to ask, but what you brought up really, really... Oh, it emphasised my point.
Matt points to Ack.
Yeah, Matt.
Not me.
You, as a point, as making a point and not as a direct comparison, you brought up sex offending with little children in comparison to using closed source software.
Insert.
Now,
Ack getting a shoe in.
Now, what that makes me think is...
What?
Are there some people in our community who are just really taking this whole free software thing too fucking seriously? It's software. Now, hear me out. It's really important. Yeah, I know. And it's really important to us because we live and breathe software and we do stuff with computers all the time. But for fuck's sake...
It's not as important as sexual abuse.
It's a fucking word processor. It's your web browser. Now, I know it's important, and ideally, I would love to see everything GPL'd or equivalent free software license, because I think that would be good. But I'm not going to...
Stand in the street
corner. I'm not going to have a heart attack about it.
Mm. Now, here's my problem with that, right? If you go back to, say, 1910 and wander through Alabama... They'd have said, they're only black
people.
But
you cannot relate it to racism.
Why?
Because it's fucking software.
Because you don't think it's important.
Exactly.
But people who are racist didn't think the people that were being racist, that were important.
For Christ's sake.
Question.
No, come on, I mean, because you don't think it's important, therefore, it's okay to dismiss it and say, it's not actually a very important thing, so why are you getting so het up about it? That's not saying to Martin Luther King, why are you getting so het up about it?
No, it's not.
Why isn't it? That's only because you think racism's important and software isn't.
Right, racism...
I don't think Matt just thinks that that's as important. Whereas, I think... I can see your point, but the fact is that a very small subset of people feel that free software is as important as something such as racism or sexual abuse
to kids.
And
they need to get fucking real.
Right? And I think the point Matt's making is that the general population think that racism and abusing children is far more important to stop than...
Now the, they do.
We're not going to win anyone over by comparing the two.
You can't compare the two. At this moment, they do. 100 years ago, they did not.
What? The word...
It's true. Right.
Okay, but...
100 years ago, people didn't think racism was important. They didn't think it was a thing to worry about.
And
200 years ago, they didn't think sexism was
Who is being put into oppression by Microsoft Office?
Every single office worker is being put into oppression by Microsoft
Not
Office.
Not on the same level in any way. And I'm sure deep down you know it does not compare.
The thing is, there's oppression. There's oppression not being allowed to sit on a fucking bus, or oppression your family not being welcome, or physical abuse to your family. And there's oppression of fucking business people. And I'm with Matt on this. I think I'm passionate about free software, but there's different levels of importance of things in life. And I agree that free software is fundamentally important within the sphere of IT. It's important. And
what you're saying is IT isn't that important in the big scheme of things.
I think in the scheme of life, IT plays a part. But I don't think that part is... I think there's different levels of oppression. There's oppression in the IT world, but that oppression generally stays within the IT world.
No, look at things like that. This is why I think projects like the $100 laptop are really important, because you take that sort of thing out to areas where they couldn't people have difficulty reading or whatever, and you give them access to the world.
Yeah, yeah. But that would still happen if I look at a Flash movie in my browser.
No, but it wouldn't happen if you didn't have free software.
And that's why free software is important.
That's the kind of difference
that
it makes.
Preaching about
and if all software was free, it would have happened 20 years ago. And think how much place like that would be if it had happened 20 years ago. But IT's not very important. It only opens up your eyes to the whole world.
Can I ask you a question? Talking about oppression, do you believe that the oppression of someone from an ethnic community and the oppression of a defenceless child and the oppression of somebody who works in an office are all equal levels of oppression?
No. No. The difference, I think, is that there being closed source software doesn't oppress individual people. And that I think, is why racism and sexism and child abuse are different, because they target individual people as well as a community.
But the point is... I think if we were to tear open your perspective, I think that you would layer things up fairly equal, the same kind of way that we'd layer them up, right? I think that you'd say that the oppression of somebody from having to use closed source software, in the scheme of things, in the scheme of the whole world, if we put the world into a big stack, it's not as demonized, it's not as terrible as the kind of oppression in terms of racism, in terms of child abuse, in terms of sexism, in terms of, all this kind of stuff.
Does anybody get hurt by closed source software? And this is a question, not a leading question, I'm asking.
Are you talking physically?
Once again, this is exactly the point I'm trying to make with things like the $100 laptop. Whole continents get hurt by a culture in which money is more important than lives.
Listen, I see what you're saying, but the fundamental problem in Africa is not that Microsoft have a software monopoly. The fundamental problem is corruption and the legacy of empire. It's not.
That's a pretty sweeping statement, which I'd like to see you back up at some point.
Well,
I think the fundamental problem is not corruption, the legacy of empire. I think the problem, and I'm not particularly qualified to comment on this, but I think the problem is that people are too far away from education. I think education would fix almost all of it. And you can bring education to people, but you can't do it if everyone wants to charge you £20 for school books, if everyone wants to charge you £80 for a copy of Microsoft Office.
The thing is, though, is that agreed with you, education is fundamentally important, right? Education is important. All of these different things are important, right? People need clean water, they need good education, they need safe communities and all the rest of it. And they need good access to computing, and they need good access to IT. I think the problem is that the way some people, and I'm not including Mako here at all, but the way some people have a perspective on free software is as if that's as important as everything else, as if that's more important than everything else. And it plays a part in it, I think that is the thing. It plays a sufficient part in it.
What concerns me, just briefly, is that people will hear discussions such as, racism is as bad, closed source software is as oppressive as racism or can be compared. And you genuinely believe that. And you have arguments to back it up, that's fine. But most people out there who have never heard of free software will listen to that and just think that we're fucking freaks.
Yes, I know.
And we can't have that, because it is important. I wouldn't be sitting on this program if I didn't believe that free software was important. I wouldn't fucking bother hassling about with crappy things that don't work if I didn't think that free software wasn't important. Right?
That sums it up.
But
Matt's perspective on free software.
Going back to your earlier question.
Which is, again, Benjamin Hill's perspective on it. That it's broken, but you live with it anyway.
It's that time again.
What time is it?
It's time for the emails, because it's the end of the show.
I was just looking at my watch then.
2300:01.
Right, so let's do the emails then.
So it won't be 2300-01 when they listen to it.
We've had loads of emails.
We've had quite a few emails. Some of them were quite boring, though, so we're not going to read all of them out.
Yep. Don't wrap it up at all,
Matt. I was going to say that we've had lots of emails and we're only going to pick a few, but if you want to put it that way, Matthew. Bastard. So which ones were boring, Matthew?
Yeah, name names. Come on.
What we're basically saying here is that email we don't read was boring. So if you send an email, yeah. We didn't read it.
Matt's opinion is not the opinion of the show.
Anyway, got an email here from James Robertson, who's written to say, I just wanted to say how much I enjoy your show, and without it, people like me would be lost for direction with using Linux.
Oh, that's nice.
Now, we keep meaning to do some kind of thing to help new people get involved in the community and where they should look and stuff, and that'd be a really good thing.
Yeah.
He says, all the best for the new year. It's going to be progressively more interesting than last year. I can just tell. Thank you, because we can't tell. And he says, thanks for mentioning Twatech Radio to me. Their last show was top notch, which is good. So I'm glad that we could fucking send people to our competitors.
Thank you very much.
But we're all one big community, aren't we? I forgot about that.
We are. We're all one big happy family.
Okay.
We've had an email from Christopher Yeemon.
Yeemon.
Yeemon. Comments about eye candy. Christopher is saying, I love Lug Radio episode 5, been listening for a while, and the Lug Radio syndrome has thoroughly embarrassed me on the train many times. Thanks for that, BTW. Just wanted to comment on the eye candy discussion. I agree with the stance on drop shadows, but many of those other slight examples like rounded window corners and striped windows that you've mentioned are still useful to making an electronic device seem more human.
Ah.
I think the bouncing icons on the dock are an indication that the program that has been launched is loaded, and the striped windows give the window a texture that, while not distracting, makes it easier to look at for long periods of time as opposed to a window with one colour.
Take a breath, John.
So, yeah.
Was that all one sentence?
Pretty much.
I think so. So, thanks for your comments. What do you... Yeah, there's lots more
there's
comments.
There's loads more. But, he mentions the word platform.
I can't actually read the screen from this angle. So,
is it Trinidadian stranded in New York?
Yeah, apparently so.
I've seen that guy from Trinidad.
So,
He says here, transparencies are complete bollocks.
Transparencies are complete bollocks.
Is that like, you know, transparency... you know, them transparent sheets of plastic that you write on to do presentation?
That's right, yeah.
They're not complete bollocks. I've seen them.
Transparent aluminum.
All they make you do is squirt.
What?
Sorry, squint.
Can you imagine the windows in his house?
Oh, sorry, this is transparent windows and stuff.
Yes, you dickhead.
Totally agree with you. Nice one. Well done.
Aero looks well like Cassie said. What's
Christopher,
Aero?
Whatever your name is.
Aero.
Aero is the new, the Windows
Aero's look like
user interface.
Matthew P. Ravel.
Right, Ian Rawlings has written to show@lugradio.org with the subject line of VAT returns, etc. Oh, lovely. He says, sorry to be brief, rebuilding my backup server. Why is that always the one that goes down first? Anywho, in a podcast that's currently playing, don't know which one, someone, don't know who, said something about any business having to have a Windows box around so they can do their tax returns. I know people who use a feckin' Acorn Archimedes to run their vatable businesses, so I doubt it. Says he's just started out with the whole self-employed business. He's using
so
Quasar.
What?
Which is a commercial product that's available for free if you don't bother with them with questions.
People are running a web server on a fucking Commodore 64. Is that a good example of computer use?
Ah, fantastic.
Well, I'd be interested to see whether people using ARX to do all their VAT returns are just using a spreadsheet and doing all the VAT calculations themselves, or whether they're using something like TurboCash or Quicken.
TurboCash.
That actually does most of the work.
TurboCash. Sponsored by Lug Radio.
508? Yes.
Hey.
Hello. How you doing?
Sure. From Morten Juul Johansen.
Yes, Morten Juul Johansen from Denmark writes in. I've been listening to your show for a long time, and sometimes drop by the forums to add a non-Ubuntu element to the discussion. Good on ya, is all I can say for that
from
one.
From Debian.
No, he's from Kubuntu.
How about talking to Ian Murdoch about Debian and Ubuntu? Last spring, he wrote a bit on his weblog about Debian as a distribution and Debian as a Linux platform, and how Ubuntu sometimes seemed to be on a slippery slope with regards to integration from the Debian environment.
Now, we have actually...
So that was quite interesting.
We have actually spoken to Mr. Ian before.
Well, he should have come to Lug Radio Live 2005.
We? Yeah, we've
when did we speak to Ian Murdoch?
We've swapped emails with him. And,
I mean, you've swapped emails with him. I've certainly not swapped any emails with Ian Murdoch.
Well, no, we have kind of.
That's the show. Show@lugradio.org swapped emails.
Yep, we have.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we have.
All right.
Alright, blimey. That's cool.
Stuart, here's an email for you.
Anyway, no, we got an email from Campbell Barton.
Yep.
Email from Campbell Barton, who says, don't read this out loud. Damn, now you will just piss me off. Fucking got that right.
Tough luck, buddy.
He says, I really like your show. At first it didn't excite me much, but since then I've listened to other Linux podcasts and they are bollocks.
No comment.
Thanks very much. This is a bloke who bumped into Miguel Diacarzo at the airport. And went, all right, Miguel, and then apparently he killed him and dressed up in his skin. he says one of the reasons he likes GNOME is the direction it's going, integrating with X.org, the Human Interface Guidelines, Beagle, Cairo, ties with Ubuntu.
Yep.
The GNOME people are all, yeah, they're really brilliant, completely separate to GNOME projects, and all the KDE people go, that's the reason they integrated them is because all GNOME people have invented them. So, you know.
Thorny subjects.
Staying out of that debate. But he says, KDE is a very good Windows clone. I can't decide whether that's intended as a compliment.
Is that a punch in the face?
A bokeh or a brickbat. But he says, cheers and thanks for the show. Thank you very much for writing to us.
And kudos to Campbell, because he's been pushing the effort to build a replacement for Cubase for editing the show as well.
Really? Surely we'll have Jono edit soon.
He's really been pushing it forward, and he's like writing some code and stuff like that. So keep up the good work.
He'll have to be quick though, won't he?
We need it to happen.
Because like Mad Barnett will be out real soon.
Well,
it?
It's basically going to be Mad
it
Barnett.
It is going to be Mad Barnett.
Oh, okay. Because it's based upon, yeah.
Oh, so he's doing all the work and you just had.
Well, we said that we haven't got time to write it.
Here's a spec.
And this guy's interested in.
Exactly.
This guy's interested in working on it and other people.
So hang on. So you're thinking that people should write an editor for Jono without actually asking Jono what he wants from an editor? Right, I get it. Yeah, speak to them users. Anyway. Hey, John, I'd read an email.
Next one is from Phil Clifford, talking about video conferencing. And he says, hi, probably last to mention this, but in episode 5, somebody wanted to do cross-platform video conferencing. Maybe VideoLAN can be used to do what they need. I thought the VideoLAN could do streaming, but I've never tried it myself.
Well, VideoLAN certainly can. There's a thing called the VideoLAN server which does it, and VLC, the VideoLAN client,
yes,
talks to it. But I believe the VideoLAN client can also stream by itself as well, which I don't really understand. But it's a bit of a bodge job. You imagine if you're doing sort of a video conferencing, you just say to people, okay, you know, bring it up in something like a game window and then click and then both of them get a window, as opposed to going, right, okay, I'll stick the output from my webcam into VideoLAN and stream it to them, and they'll stick the output of their webcam into VideoLAN and stream it to me, and we'll both hook up at each end. You could do it, but it's a bit of a bodge.
I don't know, I mean, it's just basically pulling video off a device, isn't it? But then again, you know?
Yeah.
Has anyone tried this? Let us know. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Who's next?
Matthew.
It's me. I've got an email from a Mr. Doc, where he just says Doc, actually. He says, hello, Lug Radio. I think it's time that someone started calling Google out. They certainly gain a lot of...
Google! Out!
They certainly gain a lot of benefit from Linux and open source.
Out of me, then.
They certainly gain a lot of benefit from Linux and open source on the back end of their systems, yet seem to continually ignore anything but Windows with any knobweb...
Knobweb? You sound like a shit cobweb.
presumably it's what you get if you don't use your knob very much.
That's a shit interface, by the way.
The phallic spider.
With any non-web-based offerings, for example, Google Earth, Picasa, and Google Desktop all seem to require Windows. Add to this the news that the new Google Video Download service is coming and will require Windows as well. What do you guys think about this? Well,
I know what I think about it, which is that if you look at, say, the Google Pack with all the downloads for Windows, Google are pushing that on Windows because Windows people don't know about them. Yeah. There's people already using Firefox. They're already using the stuff that...
Kudos to Google.
That Google are pushing out. They feel the need to help Windows people because, you know... The Windows people need the help. We don't need the help. Are you using Internet Explorer?
Is this the calm before the storm, before they bring out the operating system that's going to terrify the boots off Microsoft, according to everyone?
Hey.
According
to me, so
my fucking chin is going to terrify the boots off Microsoft. Yeah.
Okay.
So,
go for it, Aid.
Aid
scrolls.
Looking for
not
title. Use,
ah, not I got some paper. From Rob.
Rob Animal.
Rob Teha.
Rob who?
Teha.
Rob Teha.
Rob the Terrible.
He says, hi guys, I'm listening to the January the 3rd show at the moment. You're currently discussing the patches and things to get that distributions apply to their stock open source software. Just for your information, the best distro to handle these sort of patches It's the distro that distro that easily shows what each patch does is Gentoo.
Yeah, fucking yeah, the distro is called Chinux is what it's called.
Fucking Chinux. GNU / Chinux.
Can you pipe that to DevNol, please? Gentoo not only pulls patches from Debian and from Fedora, but they also apply same sort of patches to the stuff in their package as well. You guys really love to talk shit about Gentoo, perhaps you've convinced yourself that it's too hard. I think they have, to be quite honest. Dealing with those patches is really one of the... I'm just going to scroll.
Do you use Gentoo, by the way?
I'm not man enough to use Gentoo, mate.
I think maybe you've convinced yourself it's too easy, Rob, to be honest with you.
Dealing with all those patches is really one of the great things about Gentoo. You see exactly what is being applied, and you can look into the patch before you install the software. You can even turn off a fucking patch before you install the software if you decide you don't like it.
Once
it's
again,
fucking amazing!
I'm
going
to build my own car to get home.
Gentoo, that's what you need.
Once again, it's great if you want to know what a fucking patch is. If you don't want to know what patches are and just want to use software, then it's...
Why? In his defense, he was talking about it in the context of you saying, I don't want to download my own kernel because then I've got to apply 100 Ubuntu kernel patches.
Yes.
So that's a pain in the arse.
But the point of that discussion was about whether patches go upstream or not.
Yeah.
And yes, with Gentoo, I mean, their whole world is based around source code,
I want to point out that he says you can look at a patch and decide whether you want it or not. So I could look at a thing where they've taken out a line where it said g_get_environment(something). And they've replaced it with the line which says g_save_environment. And I'm going to go, oh, now, is that going to improve my use of this piece of software? Or do I not fucking understand one tiny bit about what it is?
And incidentally, yes, we could use Gentoo. I think we could, with the exception of AIDS.
I've had Gentoo on my machine a couple of years ago, and I thought, fuck this for a game of bollocks.
What would a game of bollocks look like, incidentally? It would be like Hungry Hippos, sort of.
So thanks,
Rob.
On.
Yeah, thank you.
Yep.
Nice one.
Rob, thank you very much. You are welcome to continue using Gentoo, and yes, if you want to know which patches you're applying...
What?
If you want to know which patches you're applying, then it's really handy for you.
Yes.
Which is excellent.
It is. Horses for courses.
So thanks for that. You're wrong. We've got a mail here from George Martin, who says, I've not listened to regular radio for about a month, currently at series 2 episode 5.
Ooh.
Wondering if Matt did good on his exam.
I passed 3 of them, failed one because I didn't have time to revise.
What were you doing, were you busy being a newlywed?
No, I was at work until late hours.
God damn it.
Late hours? In Matt hours, that's like 8 o'clock at night.
Yeah, when I've got to drive an hour and a half home.
I suppose you've got a point there.
He says, I've been using Linux since 1998 and most recently converted to Ubuntu because Akka adores it so much, so I decided to give it a shot. Fucking glorious.
You're my favourite fan.
We like you. What's his fucking name? Hang on a second.
Georgie Martin.
Adolf Hitler.
George Martin. We like you, George. Nice one. What a player. Wife also a Linux user. She's working from home, so she puts OpenOffice and Evolution to work. When she goes to work with a laptop, I can just run rsync on her home directory.
Rsync.
So she can take her stuff. Simply love
company,
it.
Isn't it?
Rsync. I don't care what anyone says. Contentious statement of the day. I don't care what anyone says. Linux just works unless you are a stupid, lazy, ignorant bastard. I respect him for that, but I respect him even more because he follows it up with this 50 megaton zinger. Right? Windows and Macs and such are good for some stuff, but at the end of the day, they both suck duck's cock.
He's obviously listened to the show before, though.
Ducks have cocks.
I do believe he may be the new Lug Radio community hero, this bloke.
Ducks don't have cocks.
Or how else
do they reproduce?
I don't know. They've got fucking bills or something.
Oh, yeah. That's the way it works, Jono. Yeah.
Didn't do biology, then, did you?
But you know, like, when a duck sticks...
If a bill's evolved, then it's just having a fucking beak job. It's not reproduction.
Beak job.
Just put it on the
tube. Anyway, shouts. He's into mad shouts.
Hang on.
Wicked
shouts. He kind of shouts in an email.
Aid. Why do you shave your hair? And he says, I assume because the crystal bald is required by Lug Radio purposes.
That was exactly why I shaved my head.
Why do you shave your hair, Aid?
I believe that's none of his business.
Well,
right, okay.
He hasn't shaved it for ages,
Matt,
by the way.
Dogs do rule.
No, thanks.
Brackets don't have one. apparently, I say Ubuntu so damn well they should record it and include it on the splash screen instead of the drum roll. That'd be fucking
no.
Wicked.
That wouldn't.
That's what we need for DAP. I hope you're listening, Mr. Shuttleworth.
That should be on the April 1st edition.
And he says, Jono, beard.
Thank you.
No, he actually says, great music.
Woohoo! Thank you.
Beard.
No.
I also love what you're doing. Keep up the good work.
Great.
George. So, thank you very much, George.
Thanks, George.
Cheers, George Martin.
Fantastic email. Okay, the last one that we've got is from Nicholas.
That's
No.
Has he gone commando?
Just Nicholas, I'm afraid. says, hi. Great shows. I've listened to a number of them. Keep up the great work. Just one point. Is the swearing completely necessary?
Fuck yeah.
How predictable are you, honestly?
It's only because I beat you to it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
No, it's not really, is it?
No, actually. No. Let's
totally unnecessary.
Let's make a pledge not to swear again on this show.
Yeah.
No!
Bollard. Yes, so, no, the swearing is necessary.
Just thinking of all time.
Well, it's not necessary, it just happens, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's fun.
We have...
For all the family.
...spoken about this ad nauseum.
This has been through the motions.
Look at Ice Passion.
Yes, we have.
We need to do our own shouts, you know?
All right, mad shouts out.
We've got mad shouts.
Who to? Bruno!
Bruno!
Bruno! Bruno's confirmed to come and do a talk at Lug Radio Live.
He's going
to
do a talk this year. Fantastic.
He's written this software in which he can note down whenever we swear, ironically, related to this, whenever we swear in an episode, he's going to log it, and he's going to give a presentation about the statistical...
prevalence.
Facts behind the Lug Radio swearing.
So okay.
It's going to be a fascinating talk.
So you're not actually going to try and swing the results now by swearing more on the shows?
No, we need to use more unusual swear words that haven't... Because he's written something, I think, so you can map a swear word to a key.
Okay.
So we need
to get the Profanosaurus out.
We need to come up with 106 different swear words. So that's
a brilliant
flange.
I'm going to get the Profanosaurus out.
Arse flaps. This is really annoying, this guy here, by the way. Anyway, yeah.
No, let's
bum fiddler.
Let's not do
that. What if we did what this guy said? Bruno wouldn't have a talk, would he?
No, exactly.
So we're keeping a Frenchman in food.
Because he's right.
Bruno's the king.
He is the king.
He is.
He translated some French stuff for me the other day. It was brilliant.
Did he?
Really? What's his name? Translate.altavista.co.uk.
No, translate.altavista was completely useless. So I mailed it to Bruno so he could translate that. And he went, no problem, and sent it back. Superb bloke. Well done, Bruno.
His command of the English language is really impressive.
Especially since he's been listening to Lug Radio.
I know.
I think you say especially since he's French.
He says bollocks more often, which is nice. Right, we need to say some other bits and pieces.
Do we?
Go and sign up for the coach travel for Lug Radio Live.
Don't forget the coaches.
Well,
we've had
an email from Ryder. No, it's not called that. It's called the magnificent but mysterious provider of coaches.
Right. Ooh. Who we nickname Rob.
Yeah. Speedy Rob.
You fucking spackers. Honestly.
He said something about, signing up, but it looks like people are... they're trying to sort out times at the moment, so discuss that on the wiki or the forums.
Get over there, make your opinions known.
Yes, indeed. Lug Radio Live, 22nd, 23rd of July.
This year.
Yeah. The countdown begins.
Is provided.
We need to start sorting out some bits and pieces for it. The venue's all been pretty much paid off as well, so we're absolutely confirmed.
Is that new?
Has it been paid off, or has a deposit been paid?
No, they've paid a lot, I think.
We need to...
Fantastic.
Yeah, we need to sort out the...
you're only the treasure,
Lug Radio
worry.
Live official hotel.
Yes.
Brackets. S. Close brackets.
keep submitting
Those
your
are,
papers.
Parentheses, aren't they?
No, the brackets were not American.
Oh, okay.
Keep submitting your papers. We want people to come
keep
and do lightning
them
talks.
In. Keep
so,
sending
so
them
keep
in.
So keep sending them in. We need you to just come and talk about anything. And if you want to do some cool Lug Radio Live... do let us know.
Yeah, that'd be brilliant.
Is there anything else we need to mention?
Forums, #lugradio.
We mention these things all the
Leave
time.
Leave us some voicemails, come on.
No
blank ones either.
We've had three voicemails recently. If that was you, they were blank.
Got your number.
No, we haven't. That's my thing. We haven't got the number.
The freaky
and,
bugger
blank.
Who recorded that weird thing about monkeys.
That was it.
We need to mention Look Queer for the New Year.
Look
yep,
Queer
still going
for the
on
New Year.
Yep.
It's still open. It's not too late to get your pictures in.
Keep sending them in.
I've some good entries, but stiff competition.
Less naked ones next time, please.
You're so funny, man.
One of which, the guy who sent the
Osiris.
Email doesn't really particularly look that queer for the New Year.
Oh, no.
Just
looks the guy who looks hard.
Hard for the New Year. He's a scary looking bloke, so if that's you, just put on a wig or something. Yeah, so anything else we need to sort out?
Osiris, are those two men kissing in your photo?
They are men, aren't
girls.
They?
They're men.
They look like men. If they're girls, are offended now, aren't they?
Just a little bit, I expect. Master of tact. Nice.
Anyway,
one.
Yes, and go to planetadvocacy.johnobacon.com.
Whatever.
And you can cut that out.
Yes. So,
I think instead you should go to chin.lugradio.org.
Chin.lugradio.org.
Get right, over there.
It's been
see the chin raccoon.
Let's wrap it up then.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
See you later.
Bye.